Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He is my good buddy and real estate expert, Jason Hartman. Hartman, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Hey, Gammon. Good to see you, buddy.
All right. We just got done with our mastermind group, the collective in Dallas. That was an incredible time. Do you still have your cowboy hat?
I did not bring my cowboy hat. I really liked the looks of that thing.
But it was cool, wasn't it?
It didn't pack in my suitcase very well, so I left it for the housekeeper.
But yeah, I gave it to Adriana to take back to Medellin and put my apartment back there. For those of you who aren't following this, our mastermind group did this incredible event on Saturday evening at this venue with a mechanical bowl and pictures and dinner and drinks and dancing. And it was just absolutely sensational. And when all of our members came in, the guy was there and he actually made a custom cowboy hat for everyone. He bent it like to the shape of your head and everything. Yeah. It was really neat. But
those were good looking hats, man.
Yeah, they're cool.
Really, I don't look good in hats. You look good in hats. Man, that was a good looking hat. I really liked it.
I look good in everything, buddy.
I look sharp in that hat.
But all right, but George, no one wants to hear about our cowboy hats.
No. I got to do quick thing. Okay.
All right.
On that, I got to tell everybody, you should have seen George on Saturday night, who was like, he was sort of coordinating all the mechanical bull riders. He was having a blast. He was out there with his t-shirt on, took off his coat, and George was just high-fiving everybody as they got on and off the bull. And that was a lot of fun.
And I was telling the guy that was working the bull what to do. I was telling him to increase the level.
Did that to me.
Oh, yeah. When Hartman got in there, I'm like, take it up to advance number 5. I wanted that bull to kick you off as fast as possible. I wanted you to really go flying. I think I actually scraped my elbow, but I had everyone doing it. The members, I got Kenny McElroy out there, Rolo Tomasi. I think I got him out there. A bunch of people that were with it. Even my assistant and one of my editors, Stephanie, I got them out there.
Yeah. And I think Adriana went on the bull too.
Oh yeah. Adriana, she's my assistant. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we got Angelique out there. Anyway, so you guys, you got to check out the collective.
we'll have information on it
at Rebel Capitalist Live. So go to Rebel Capitalist Live and you'll hear about it there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, folks, those collective events, they are over the top. On my show, when I talked about it on Monday, Monday's episode, I just said they're ridiculous. In a good way.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. But I tell you, one of the super highlights was having Dr. Peter McCullough speak. Yeah. And George, I saw the picture you took with him on the stage with his book and you know, he was great. Really just, you know, one of the great talks, but everybody was awesome. It's another awesome weekend in the books.
Yeah, for sure. And if you guys want to find out more about it, we'll talk about it at Kenny's event coming up, Limitless in Phoenix, and then my event, Rebel Capitalist Live in Miami, June 24th through 26th. Just get the tickets at rebelcapitalistlive.com. But let's get into the real estate market, man.
Last thing I must say, though, our next trip is a vacation in Mexico, Playa del Carmen. So that's an actual vacation. We're going to spend 5 days together. It's going to be a lot of fun. Anyway,
let's hang out with Simon Black.
And
his new child. So he's on kid number 2 he's having there in Cancun. So
the sovereign man. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the real estate market. One thing I wanted to go over is adjustable rate mortgages increasing.
Yeah.
But one thing I found fascinating in looking at a chart is the average price point for an adjustable rate mortgage, as far as the average purchase price of the home that's being used with an ARM, is way higher than fixed rate. I mean, it was up around $700,000-$800,000. Yep. That's the average sale price for a home where the buyer is using an adjustable rate mortgage. And I believe the average sales price for a fix was right around $250,000-$300,000. So why is that, first and foremost?
Well, I'm not sure, but it could signify that people are using the adjustable rate mortgages to stretch a lot more,
right?
Which in the long run could be a problem. As we know, the Great Recession was largely caused by this sort of, you know, we all probably saw this one time in our life in maybe biology class in school or something where, you know, they fed like a rat to a snake, right? And, you know, you got this big bulge going through the snake. It's really weird looking. And that's what happened the last time around with these adjustable rate mortgages, where the, you know, they gave them a teaser rate and then 5 years later, they got a 3-1 arm or a 5-1 arm. And then you had that adjustment and it caused payment shock. This time though, I hate to say it's different, but I'll say that a little bit because of course they're much more careful of how they're underwriting even the adjustable rate loans, and they tend to be longer. Most of them are 7 years before they start adjusting.
So I'm just wondering, I'm trying to figure out the percentages right off the top of my head. I remember this article that I saw on CNBC said that demand for ARMs are at a 14-year high.
Yeah.
But they're not at the levels yet that they were, I'd call it 2006. Then they're right. About 30% of the overall mortgage market. And recently they've gone from about 3% up to 11% of total mortgages. But when you combine the total value of all those mortgages, they're up at 19%.
Mm-hmm.
And so another thing that I was thinking about is if that's a higher end buyer, my theory was that their purchasing power would be more impacted by the stock market. And if the Fed is raising rates, if stocks are coming down, like we've seen significantly in the NASDAQ, that may affect their ability to buy homes. And if they get squeezed with that adjustable rate, then that could put further pressure on the prices at the high end, even nominal prices.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the wealth effect is dissipating to some extent, as we've seen the crypto markets really encounter tough times, the stock markets. So the only thing holding up so far really is an asset class is real estate. But again, that may not last because we are seeing a little bit of a transition. And, you know, it's kind of like the weatherman says, George, T-E-T-T, too early to tell. But I think the next 2 months are going to be very telling as to the direction of the real estate market because, you know, we see inventory uptick a little bit, but it's still such a small amount. It's just not significant yet, but we'll see. I mean, Redfin says demand has declined a bit. Requests for home tours and so forth has declined a bit, but we got a long way to go before supply and demand meet in sort of that sweet spot of what we'll call a normal market.
So yeah, we'll but the way I always look at it is the price kind of set at the margin. I would assume the total housing stock in the United States is, 50 million homes or something like that?
Oh, it's about 140 million. Yeah.
140 million?
Yep.
Okay. So you got 140 million homes. And I was looking at a chart from, I believe, the New York Times that showed that on average, there's about 500,000 homes for sale in the United States. That was throughout 2021. So you can have, if there was, let's say Blackstone just dumped 80,000 of the homes they have, that would affect the price significantly for all 140 million homes, even though there's a very low percentage of those homes that are actually for sale. And
yeah, so let's unpack that for a minute, okay? So first off, you hear real conflicting numbers on the inventory levels, and here's one big reason. The National Association of Realtors, or NAR, publishes their inventory levels, and they always appear higher because I think they do it wrong. They count for sale homes in the MLS. They count contingent sales, which are sold, but they're contingent upon something happening, like someone selling another house to buy the house they bought. Right. And then they also count pending sales as available inventory. Now, Altos Research, I like the way they do it better. They only count actual for sale homes. Mm. Okay. So that number is right around 300,000 now. It was, it's a little lower than 300,000. Okay. For Altos. NAR will tell you it's about 600,000-700,000, something like that. I don't like the way they do it as well. So, I don't know. You know, when you say 500,000, I'm not sure what stat they're using. And that's the problem with a lot of this stuff. You know, it varies because they're using a different survey. But if Blackstone dumped 80,000 homes on the market all at once, which they probably wouldn't ever do it all at once.
No, I think they definitely scale it over a period of time. But I definitely think it can impact that equilibrium of supply and demand that we were talking about.
Yeah, I agree with you. It definitely would. However, you know, it depends how quickly that inventory is absorbed by the buyers. And, you know, you see a lot of people on YouTube and read a lot in the media about people talking about the forbearance and the foreclosures that would have happened but didn't happen because of forbearance and eviction moratoriums and all of this kind of stuff, right? But, you know, what they don't tell you, and there's one particular guy on YouTube that I want to get on my show. He agreed to come on a long time ago, but then never booked the interview. And I'm going to get him. You might know who I'm talking about, who's been really gloomy about the real estate market for about a year and a half to 2 years. And, you know, it's kind of faulty what he's saying, because he says there would have been another 700,000 homes that would have come up for sale, right? And let's assume he's right about that. Let's give him that, you know, which is a huge leap to give him that, right? But let's say he's right. What he doesn't tell you, he acts like it comes on all in one snapshot at time, and that inventory doesn't come on sporadically, right?
Right.
And of course, the demand and the absorption happens sporadically as well. So this stuff is harder than it looks to figure out, right? Because
he's also just saying, well, if the government wouldn't have done this, but yeah, you have to consider the government right now. And that's what I always say is on my videos, is to answer economic questions. You have to start by answering political questions in today's day and age. That's just the reality. In fact, I did a whiteboard video just this morning where I asked the question, are real estate prices just about ready or just ready to crash, or something like that title, or are real estate prices going to crash, I think.
Right.
And I went through all these reasons why the prices could come down, but the conclusion of that video is no, they won't crash. Number one, because real estate prices never crash. Even if you go back to the GFC, it took them 6 years to go from their peak down to their trough. So that's not a crash in my mind. A crash is the stock market in March of 2020.
Right.
You know, when it's down 20-30% within the matter of weeks. That's a crash.
Yeah, I agree.
But we could see nominal prices come down. Definitely could see real prices come down when you adjust for inflation. But the other conclusion I came to is that although we could see nominal prices come down, like I just said, I think the government would step in and try to come up with some sort of scheme, even if inflation was running hot, in order to prop up the market. Because number one, they're not smart enough to connect the two, home prices and
amazingly,
and CPI, purchasing power, aggregate demand. But number two, we have this weird thing with the average Joes and Janes, that for some reason, consumer price inflation is really, really bad. But asset inflation is really, really good.
Yeah, right.
You notice that? So as long as we have asset inflation, well, that's great. We just don't want the consumer price inflation, as though they're not connected in any way. So I think even if the CPI was running hot at 9-10%, like we saw come out in the UK today, by the way, I don't know if you saw that CPI print, 9%, their highest since they
crazy
tracking their CPI.
Yeah. So just double that for the real number.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. But even if we get to that level, I think the central planners could still justify some sort of housing scheme to try to prop up the markets, because they just, you know, the average Joe doesn't connect those dots. I don't know if you saw what they're proposing in Australia right now. Did you see that?
I'm sorry, you cut out for a minute. What happened in Australia?
Oh, did you see what they're proposing down there to try to prop up their housing market?
No, what, more quarantines and a police state? Just kidding. I mean, unbelievable.
I wouldn't doubt it. But no, they're coming out, they're proposing this scheme where the government buys 40% of your house.
Oh, yeah. I did hear like an inkling of that, but I didn't dive into
it. So you only have to come up with the down payment and make monthly payments for 60% of the purchase price. But the government owns, has a 40% equity position in your house.
Well, so, you know what they say, George, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. So that's
exactly
the first
what I said in my video. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see your video, by the way.
Well, no, it's not out yet. It's not out yet, but that's when I mentioned that fact, I said, maybe this is how we get to 2030 where you own nothing and you'll be happy.
Right.
They, you know, in the article, it just talked about housing prices going up. So they say when housing prices go up and then you sell, then all you have to do is pay off the government their 40% equity position. But I'm like, okay, well, what if prices go down? Your equity gets wiped out. You can't make the payment. And where does the house go? Well, it goes right back to the government. They're the ones that own it.
Yeah.
And anyway, I don't want to go down that path.
That's how they end up owning everything.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
So
because, do you think it seems to me like the Fed... really, they should have been raising rates more slowly, much earlier, right? They let the economy heat up too long, in my opinion. But the most recent increases are too knee-jerky. They're too sudden and too severe, I think. They should have just done that more gradually. I mean, I don't think they should do anything because I don't think we should have a centrally planned economy, but we do. And I just think they acted too abruptly when they should have acted more slowly, but they should have done it a long time ago. You know, they should have started hiking a while back.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're in a position right now where they have to hike. I don't know that they're hiking aggressively enough. It depends on what your objective is.
Yeah.
They can't hike too much. I think they're doing the only thing they really can do, and that's try to just gradually hike rates. I mean, let's not forget, we're talking like we're at 7% or something. We're at 75 basis points, for heaven's sakes.
Fair enough.
You know, it's not like we're at even 2% or 3%. But what they're trying to do is talk down asset prices. So they don't actually have to raise rates in order to bring down that CPI print. So they know that if they took Fed funds to 3%, 4%, 5%, that would crush everything. The stock market, that I think would crush the housing market.
Right.
And nominal prices would come down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, mortgage rates would be at 10% for heaven's sakes. And then the economy would come crashing down with it. So they know that getting interest rates up to a certain level is not an option. So let's just gradually raise them and act and talk like we're Paul Volcker.
So then
hopefully asset prices will just gradually come down to a level
that's a soft landing,
where the CPI is palatable from a political position.
What's interesting is that, mortgage rates are still well below CPI inflation, which is a very rare occurrence in history.
Yeah.
And they're raising them less at a slower pace than inflation. Which is also interesting. And then of course, real inflation is maybe 15-16%. And you know, mortgage rates are still about a third of that. So if there's still a huge arbitrage opportunity, even with the higher rates, but for investors, the rents have yet to catch up with the prices. Now they've been rising quickly, but the prices have been rising more quickly and the rents always lag by about 2 years. So investors are kind of in this position where, what's that?
Your RV ratios are getting squeezed.
Absolutely. The rent to value ratio is getting squeezed. Yeah.
Well, let's kind of think through that, because I was actually on a podcast last night where we were talking about real estate and they were asking my opinion, you know, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do as a real estate investor? And I said, you know, you have to start with what your objectives are, because if your objectives are to never sell, and if you're just trying to buy positive cash flow and maybe take a prudent path to short the dollar, then I think it can make sense in certain instances, especially if you have an edge when it comes to property management and all those things that really make or break a real estate portfolio. But if you're someone that wants to do a cash out refi in 2 or 3 years, and if you're someone with an adjustable rate mortgage, or if you're someone that buys a property that has negative cash flow, expecting the appreciation to bail you out, then I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah.
What advice do you give for real estate investors in this type of market? And then maybe let's think through what advice we would give a potential homeowner who's just trying to consider whether now is a good time to buy or sell.
Yeah, well, you know, of course it depends where, right? Location is obviously important. If you're in a cyclical market, you're going to feel a downswing in the market more abruptly than in a linear market. But at Rebel Capitalist Live in January, I predicted that we would see a 12% increase in prices this year and an 8% increase in rents this year. And I think I'm going to be right on, even with the higher rates. Now, granted, if rates go up much higher, that could certainly change things. But we're still just lacking inventory. Prices are still appreciating, even in the face of higher rates. 40% of U.S. homeowners own their home free and clear. So that portends that there's not going to be a foreclosure crisis with those 40% of people anytime soon. I mean, people that have a property free and clear tend not to be foreclosed on. It's pretty rare. It'd be for property taxes or litigation or some other thing. I think keep buying. I think that, we may go through a downswing in the market, who knows, but in 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, the prices are likely to be higher than they are today. But like you said, all of that said, don't invest based on expecting appreciation. That's a dangerous thing because appreciation is not that reliable. Cash flow or rents are much more consistent and reliable than price increases. So people in cyclical markets, they buy on the come. You know, the property never makes sense the day they buy it, and they buy it simply with expecting some great appreciation to occur. It doesn't happen, and they're wiped out. And that's what we see in cyclical markets. But in good, solid linear markets, the deal still works nicely.
Yeah, I still think you got to have an edge, and you got to know that you're playing with fire. You just have to understand that you're buying when prices are incredibly high and very expensive. And so if you're someone who just wants to buy a stream of cash flow and you never want to sell the property, you know, it's just like a McDonald's. I used that example yesterday. If I was buying a McDonald's, I'm buying it for the $100,000 or $150,000 it throws off every single year in profit. I don't care about the price of my McDonald's, what I could sell it for in 2 years, 10 or even 10 years, because I never want to sell it. So if you're that type of investor, then I think, you know, move forward, but tread carefully. But if you're the type of investor where you set things up to where you have to sell in 2 years or three years,
not a good plan.
My goodness gracious.
Yeah, that's a good plan at all.
Yeah. Yeah, you're asking for big, big problems right there. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live. This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul,
Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today.
Absolutely agree. But you know, George, housing prices, it's interesting when people say they're high or they're low, right? You know, you've got to adjust obviously for the price of the house, the mortgage interest rate, and inflation, right? Those three things are the three main ingredients you have to adjust for. And I did a chart, and maybe I'll share this at your upcoming Rebel Capitalist Live, where I looked at mortgage payments on the median price house throughout history for the last 52 years. And I adjusted them for CPI inflation, and then I adjusted them for shadow stats inflation. And when you adjust that, and I'd be glad to share this as a visual if you'd like, but when you adjust that, the mortgage payment today, believe it or not, is at the lowest point in the last 52 years, with the exception of 2020. It was lower then, adjusted for CPI inflation or shadow stats inflation, either one.
Yeah, but again, this all depends or is predicated on you holding the property. Because if you're ever planning on selling the property, then even though the payment might be low now, interest rates go up and it might not affect your payment, but it's going to affect the payment of those people that you want to sell to.
Great point. So that shows us it's kind of like being a bondholder, right? Because if you have that cheap mortgage, number one, you have a sustainable investment where you're not likely to need to sell, because the deal works pretty well, right? But also you have an asset that's actually becoming more valuable. That mortgage, when there's higher rates all around you and you can't replicate that cheap mortgage, your mortgage is now even a more valuable asset because nobody can get money that cheap anymore, right?
On so, your balance sheet, yeah.
Yeah, on your personal balance sheet or your household balance sheet. And so as I've said before, this is going to cause people to hoard their houses if they can, right? They're going to do whatever they can to hoard those houses. They're going to remodel them. They're going to fix them up instead of moving. Or if they're in trouble, they're going to take on roommates. They're going to do whatever they can to keep that mortgage asset because it won't transfer to the new property, right? And so that's going to actually constrict inventory in the coming years. And I think that's the poison pill that the Fed has put into the housing market. And when I say poison pill, I mean in a good way for investors that own already, but in a bad way for first-time buyers trying to get into the housing market. It's going to constrict their choices even further.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I see a lot of cross currents there because I think that as rates rise, you pull demand forward. But I think you could come up in a scenario where you're increasing supply artificially, if maybe just temporarily.
Yep.
Well, and what I mean by that is if you're a person that's thought about selling your house, let's say over the last year, now all of a sudden you're incentivized to sell. You want to sell now because you're seeing interest rates go up and you're thinking, I need to sell right immediately. I don't want to wait because if I wait, there could be fewer buyers, or the buyers that are out there might not be able to afford the price I want to get for my house. So I see that as another potential issue on the supply side, or increasing supply
So if you're not one of the tens of millions of people who've either refinanced their house or investment property or purchased and locked in one of these, you know, super low interest rates, historically low interest rates, then you will be more motivated to do that. I couldn't agree more. But so much of the market has already locked in those low rates, and that mortgage actually becomes more and more valuable in a rising rate environment. It's more valuable to you.
Yep. I also too worry about, again, there's just all these cross currents.
Yeah, there are.
I worry about people's purchasing power because their real wages are going down to such a significant degree.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another thing that's harder to calculate or understand, I think. And so when you look at the house itself, the deal looks pretty good. Okay, it really looks pretty good. It's, you know, it's still cheap when you adjust for inflation, either by CPI or shadow stats. I can compare it to all sorts of things.
Well, the mortgage payments, but the housing price is not. Yeah. I mean, we're still adjusted for inflation. We're at all-time highs.
Right, but that monthly payment is still very low historically. But here's the problem. Here's the cross current for you, and you just alluded to it. The burden on the household from other non-housing expenses has risen dramatically. The price of food, the price of gas, the price of healthcare. And that burden is what's really harder to understand how that is going to impact their ability to buy houses. And I want to make sure we talk about one other thing. And that's the prediction I made about 2 months ago that we're going to see a lot of builder cancellations, a lot of contract cancellations. Mm-hmm. And I can suss that out with you if you'd like, because I think it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah, let's go through that, because I was reading a story in the Wall Street Journal. I think I actually referenced it in my whiteboard video, where they were talking about how higher mortgage rates really affect new home buyers. And I hadn't really thought about that, but they outlined in this article how new home buyers usually buy the house prior to it being built.
Right.
So let's, you know, rewind to 2021. If you're the average Joe and Jane first time home buyer, you're out there putting down a $5,000 deposit on this house that will be built in the future. And you're calculating what your mortgage payment is going to be based on, let's say, a 3.5% interest rate.
Yep.
Well, fast forward to a year where now all of a sudden you've got to buy the house and interest rates or mortgage rates are at 5.5%.
Yeah.
And you can't afford that payment anymore.
Right. Then the media is going to report on this. And a lot of people are going to say, this is the housing crash. And I think they're mostly wrong. And here's why. So what you said about the new home builds, that construction cycle is taking longer and longer because of the supply chain problems.
Right, they mentioned that too.
Yep. Yeah, because the labor shortages and all of that. So, you know, they might have built that home in 6 or 8 months before, but now it's 10 months, 12 months, 14, 16 months. Okay. Yep. So that problem makes this interest rate problem even worse. Mm-hmm. Because that most buyers go out, especially first-time buyers, and they buy the maximum house they can possibly qualify for. But they were qualified at a 3% mortgage. And they can't lock the mortgage in for as long as the construction takes.
Right.
So they're forced to cancel. And there's going to be a lot of these. I mean, over the next 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, we are going to hear tons of stories on this. The media is going to report on it like there's a housing crash. But what I've been saying is people need to look up. They need to look above. And what do I mean by that? Take the example. A first-time buyer, a young couple goes out, they qualify for a $350,000 house. They buy the house. The house takes a year to complete. Now they're forced to cancel the contract because they can no longer qualify. And so they are left sitting in the renter pool. They never got a house. They're just stuck in the renter pool, which puts upward pressure on rents. So that's good for investors, right? But then what happens? That house doesn't remain unsold. Simply the person that bought the $450,000 house also has to cancel, and they move down a rung and they buy the $350,000 house. Now, this makes a lot more work for the home builders and the real estate agents for sure. But the fact is, that's what happens. Everybody just moves down the socioeconomic ladder and they simply are forced to adjust their expectations with the economic reality. The first-time buyer stays in the renter pool, everybody else moves down, and a good question to ask, well, what happens at the top of the market then? And the answer is, I don't really know, because it's just kind of complicated, and in the higher end of the market, you know, people aren't always buying the maximum they can qualify for. A lot of times those are very wealthy people that, you know, they're paying cash, or they could buy much more than they're actually
buying. I think that's when it goes back to stocks.
Right, yeah. Yeah, right. Because they're more in the stock market.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. A much higher percentage of their net worth is in their 401k or right. in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ.
Yep. Like that.
All right. So let's transition over into the owner-occupant. So if you're someone who's considering buying a home for yourself and your family right now, or maybe considering selling your current house, what's going through your mind? What metrics would you use to try to determine, yes, I should buy right now, or no, I should hold off and wait, or yes, I should sell right now, or no, I should hold off and wait?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, what is the interest rate on your mortgage and what is your mortgage balance? What does that debt burden look like? So if you refinanced, hopefully you did, and you took advantage of the, you know, the lowest interest rates in thousands of years, quite literally, mm-hmm. then I would try to keep that house because it has a mortgage asset attached to it that cannot be moved and it cannot be duplicated anymore. It has utility and it has scarcity, the two value drivers for anything, scarcity and utility. And so I would try to keep that house, especially if it's in a linear or hybrid market. If it's in a overvalued cyclical market and you're trying to time it and you don't need that place to live or you want to move for whatever reason, then it's a different discussion. But just from a financial point of view, if you've refinanced and if you've got those lower rates, which you probably do, keep it.
Yeah. I think especially if you are very confident about your income or your job moving into potentially a recession, I think that's a big component of it as well. I would be far more likely, I think, to keep my house if my job was on Zoom, if I was an accountant.
Right.
Than if yeah. I was a construction worker mm-hmm. or if I worked in retail or something like that. That would be a different calculation.
Here's one for you. There's another giant industry, the mortgage industry.
Yeah, right. So yeah. You work in the mortgage industry, it might not be your income might not be that safe moving forward.
Yeah. And let me just give you an interesting anecdote about the mortgage industry. You know, being from Orange County, California, I am intimately familiar with the mortgage industry. I've owned a couple of mortgage businesses over the years. And George, I'll tell you, commercial landlords, office landlords, they absolutely hate mortgage companies as tenants because when they're in the boom times, they expand rapidly, they take on a whole bunch of space, and when the rates tick up just one little bit, they go under. I remember, and I think I told you the story of a mortgage company in Orange County, California, on, I think it was a Friday morning, they pulled the fire drill. So everybody would go out in the parking lot and get out of the building. There was no fire. They simply laid everybody off once they were outside of the building because they just fired everybody. And that's the way the mortgage business is. It's extremely volatile. It employs a lot of people who at the time made very high incomes during refi boom times. And then that contracts dramatically when rates tick up. So that's a big part of it. So if you're impacted by the mortgage industry, those incomes have evaporated now because it's strictly purchase business. There's no refi business anymore.
Yeah. And what would you say to the person? Well, let's go back to the potential buyer. So we talked about, you went to the potential seller, right? You said,
right.
Keep your house basically,
yep.
If you've got X, Y, and Z set up. So now let's look at the buyer. What metrics should they use to determine whether or not they should buy right now?
Well, we only have three choices: buy, rent, or be homeless. And that buyer should be looking at their rents, whatever rent they're paying now, assuming they're a renter, not a buyer yet or an owner yet. And they should just assume that those rents are still going to go up dramatically. They might think, well, I've already had two or three rent increases in the past few years, and they've been pretty dramatic rent increases. And, you know, let me just give you an example of that. I mean, these rent increases are the biggest I've ever seen in my entire multi-decade career in real estate, where someone is paying $1,200 a month and they go to $1,600. These are not small rent increases. I mean, they're huge. And most of the time the tenants say they're going to move, but then they go out and look and they say, hey, we'll just stay. We'll just have to give up a car or a car payment or something. We'll make some other arrangement, take the kids out of private school or whatever it is to afford the house because they just can't find anything else. Rents have adjusted up so dramatically. And one impact of all of these institutional landlords, American Homes for Rent, Invitation Homes that have tens of thousands of properties, they are much better at raising rents than mom and pop landlords, because they use software, yield management software, and they are relentless about raising rents. You know, if you've ever rented an apartment in an institutional apartment building complex like Kenny owns, right?
Yeah, right.
They're relentless about raising rents. Now they're doing that with single family homes. So what does this mean to investors? Well, it means that rent comps are going to have more and more upward pressure because the better landlords, and I'm not saying they're better in every way, I'm just saying they're better at getting all the yield out of those tenants, right?
But at what point does that give? Because their purchasing power isn't unlimited.
Right.
And especially in an environment, like we said earlier, where we've got negative real wage growth.
Yeah,
right. You know, their purchasing power is decreasing. So they're robbing from Peter to pay Paul. But at some point, they've got nothing left to rob from Peter.
Fair enough. Yeah, that's true. But what happens is the standard of living is what gives.
Yeah, right.
The quality of life gives.
Yep.
And so I use this example when we were both speaking at Mark Moss's event in Dallas just over a week ago, George. You came a day later, so you didn't see my part. But I shared a couple of slides that showed a property in Jacksonville, Florida, that you could buy for $1 million. It was almost 5,000 square feet. The house was gorgeous, big lot, great location, marble floors. It was beautiful, absolutely gorgeous home. $1 million, almost 5,000 feet. And then I showed what $1 million buys you in New York City. And it was 653 square feet. Not even one bedroom, just a little loft over like a mini kitchen, right? And that's what gives. The point I'm trying to illustrate there is that lifestyle is just reduced. That's what happens with inflation. It hurts most people. It reduces their lifestyle.
Yeah.
So the tenant in that property is not necessarily the same tenant. It's a dynamic thing. If they can't afford it, they simply move out and they move down.
Right.
They get a smaller house in an inferior neighborhood, in a school district that's not as good, in an area with higher crime rates, whatever. They just get less. And it's a sad reality of a centrally planned economy that is a kleptocracy, where people, their debt is just, or their assets are just stolen from them through inflation.
Yeah, right. So that person that's considering buying, they've got to look at the, I always suggest they look at the RV ratio as though they're an investor. And if
Absolutely.
The RV ratio is very, very low, then it's going to be a better financial decision to continue to rent,
right,
and not to buy, maybe wait for prices to come down, you know, if they ever do. Although, again, that can take a long, long time. But if you're someone who's considering buying in a market that is linear, that is, I would argue, in a red state like Florida or Texas, too.
Of course.
Very important now.
Right.
Then maybe you consider buying even as an owner occupant if the RV ratio is higher or would make sense from a standpoint of an investor. So I guess maybe connect those dots for the people listening. Why should an owner occupant care about an RV ratio?
Yeah, they should definitely care. And your point is well said. So let's do an example of that. And just for ease of numbers, let's say we're talking about a $200,000 entry-level house, which is almost non-existent anymore.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, it's an easy number. Okay. So if you can rent that $200,000 house for less than $1,400 a month, less than a 0.7 RV ratio,
okay,
you're probably pretty good renting. That's a pretty good deal for you as the renter. right? But you have to understand there is still a lot of remaining upward pressure on rents in the system that has not worked its way through. So if you can renegotiate your lease and get a longer term lease, I would, because expect your landlord to raise your rent. It is there. There's still a lot of rent growth coming. Okay. Or, you know, rent disaster coming for tenants, whichever side of the trade you're on. And, but if, you're paying $2,000 a month or a 1% RV ratio, then it's going to be better to buy almost always. So usually what happens is if the property is below, say, $350,000 or $400,000 today, those numbers used to be lower, you know, in the past. If we were doing the show a couple years ago, I would have given a lower number. But $350,000 to $400,000 or less, almost always you should buy that house. If it's more than that, more questions come up, because the the higher the price of the house, the better the rent to value ratio for the tenant and the worse it is for the owner.
Yeah. So let me say that another way, and just take it to an extreme. If you've got a house that you're renting for, let's say $3,000 a month, and it's a $2 million home, don't buy it. Just rent it, because you are getting a way better financial deal by renting that house, because the RV ratio is so low. You know, a $2 million home at a 1% RV ratio, you'd want to get $20,000 a month for rent. Right. Well, you're renting that for $3,000, taking it to an extreme, you know.
Yeah, that's an extreme, but
don't
yes.
buy, just continue to rent.
That's the deal of the century. Renew your lease and agree to increase the rent to $3,500 and get a 10-year lease.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But if that house that you're considering buying, it is a $200,000 house and it rents for $2,000 a month, then it's probably a better deal to go ahead and buy it, even as an owner-occupant.
Right, yep.
Yeah, that's what's going to make most financial sense.
Yeah. Okay. And just understand, though, the only thing I want to remind people is, regardless of what the RV ratio is today, just know that the rent is still rising significantly. So expect further increases.
Yeah, expect for what would change your outlook on that? What would make you say, you know what, I was very bullish on rent prices. Now I'm getting a little bearish.
Well, the more the housing market softens now, you know, it's got a long way to go before it softens, but say it softens, say interest rates go up a lot, okay, and we see much higher mortgage rates, which reduces housing affordability, that simply forces people to stay in the renter pool, and that puts more upward pressure on rents. So it's kind of counterintuitive to some people, but people that own a lot of real estate and have good mortgages and good debt structures on those properties, they actually like high interest rates because their rental yields improve. And, you know, that assumes they're not continuing to build their portfolio, right? So say someone's an investor who's done really well, they've got 100 single family homes that they own. Okay, we've got one client now that's got about 130 that they bought through our network. And he wants to get 500 houses. And if they've got that and they say, hey, you know, 100 houses, that's a lot, it's more than enough, I'm just going to sit tight and I'm just going to manage my properties and have a yield. If interest rates go to 10%, no investors are going to be entering the market, right? So, or very few, right? Prices would have to come down a lot to offset that interest rate increase. And they're going to see massive upward pressure on their rents. And similarly, when the housing market is super hot, you usually see downward pressure on rents. Now,
but that's my point. Usually there's an inverse relationship between rents and prices. But what we've seen since really 2012 is they can both go up at the same time.
Agreed.
Rents and prices. And so my point is, if they can go up at the same time, then I think they can go down at the same time. It's definitely possible.
I don't know about that. And here's why. Here's the difference from the 2012 mark. And I was just about to mention that. And that is that there is a housing shortage. So we've had such a construction shortfall over the last 10 years that we've seen both go up.
Yeah, now, but let's take it to an extreme. If we just waved a magic wand and took Fed funds from 75 basis points to 10% tomorrow, I guarantee you rents would come down.
Because you think so?
We would go into an economic depression like you can't even fathom.
Well, okay.
It would make the 1930s look like a picnic. And what would happen is
that's a good point,
because the stock market would come down, crypto would crash, the housing
unemployment would skyrocket.
Oh my gosh, unemployment would be at 35%. And that's the way the government measures it. Probably U3 would be at 35%.
So
in that case, we got prices coming down and we got rents coming down. And I think what would give there, Jason, to your earlier point, would be people's standard of living. You'd just have more and more and more people packed into that 650-foot apartment.
Right.
That studio apartment that one person used to rent before, a college student, now would house a family of five or a family of six. And that's exactly what I see in South America.
Yeah, that's exactly true. You know, George, I wasn't talking about it in the sense of the broader economy. When you talk about it like that, you're absolutely right. I'm just talking about, normal interest rate increases and what happens to the market where they're inverse, like you agreed. But if we have overall economic collapse with a dramatic shift like that, yes. I mean, really what's going to drive that more than anything is massive unemployment.
Right.
It's the unemployment issue. It's not even stock market crashing, crypto crashing. It's unemployment. That's the problem.
Yeah. See, that's where I think, and again, we're talking about probabilities here. And although this scenario that I'm outlining may be possible, the probability might not be that high, but you got to ask yourself, what is the probability of headline inflation? Or I would say it even a different way. What is the probability that we go from a labor shortage to a labor surplus?
Mm-hmm.
And what would make that happen?
Right.
Because I don't think it's just about the unemployment rate, because the amount of people in the workforce, or the labor force participation, is very, very low. So that artificially adjusts that unemployment rate, where if labor force participation goes from low to high, then you could see a labor shortage go to a labor surplus, which would increase dramatically the unemployment rate, which would lead to an environment that we are referring to. And I think the big thing that would make that happen is if asset prices really take a hit, most specifically the stock market.
Yeah, and there's one more thing we should say that could make that happen, where rents and prices decline at the same time, and that is an oversupply of housing, which is very unlikely. But if the builders somehow catch up, or if there's somehow some new construction technology that makes construction easier, cheaper, faster, of course, some disruptive technology, and that's kind of what I like about real estate. It's pretty primitive, really.
Yeah, right.
Unless we're all going to live in a force field or something, it's not likely to change too much that houses are built out of sticks and bricks still. That would also cause a problem.
Yeah, the supply is very, very tight, and aggregate demand would really, really, really have to come down for nominal prices to really start to decrease. I think the only variable there on that supply side of the equation is the amount of housing stock that's owned by these large funds that are completely agnostic when it comes to what assets they hold in their portfolio. And if they're getting a 5 or 6% return on their rental properties, if they can get a 10% return on a 10-year treasury,
they're gonna bail.
Exactly.
You know what's interesting, George, and I have not studied this. I just haven't had time to look into it, but I have been thinking about it a lot. What I would like to know is, what is their debt stack on the thousands of properties they own? How long is that debt? When does it mature? What is the rate? I know the rate's lower than a mortgage rate, because they can borrow more cheaply than we can, of course, because they just go to Wall Street. But
it would be adjustable. It's not like they've got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage on all those homes they buy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, interestingly, you can get 30-year fixed rate portfolio loans from these private equity and hedge fund groups that are lending money like crazy.
But so, I don't think even Kenny can get a 30-year. I think the longest he can get fixed is like 10 years.
10, yeah.
10 years on his debt. But yeah, who knows? Yeah. Maybe Blackstone could get a different deal than Kenny. Yeah.
Well, single family homes are also more generally considered more favorable. So,
oh, that's true.
I don't know.
Kenny's just doing multifamily, right?
He's doing apartments. Yeah.
All right, man. Well, great conversation as always. That was a lot of fun. I think we gave the viewers and listeners a lot of value there. Probably a lot of things that they haven't really thought about before.
Yeah, I agree with you. And let's do it again in a month or so, because then we're going to know so much more. Yeah. I mean, just everybody, if you want to know what's going to happen next, I say just watch the inventory levels and make sure you're getting them from the same source. Because like I said at the beginning,
what source would you suggest, Jason?
Well, I like Altos Research because they just look at what's for sale, what you can actually buy today, right? If you look at the National Association of Realtors, that's for sale, pending, and contingent. And I don't think that's a very good way to do it. But
can people just go to their website to get that information?
Yeah. Yeah, and I've had them on my show, and I'm quoting them all the time. So that's I think the better source for inventory levels. I'm not saying it's for everything, but inventory levels, I like the way they do it the best.
Well, and I'd like to remind everyone watching that you can have this discussion in about 1 month's time with Jason himself at Rebel Capitalist Live. So you got to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live ASAP. That's at rebelcapitalistlive.com. Now, for my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, buddy, where can they go?
JasonHartman.com or my podcast, The Creating Wealth Show YouTube channel. And you were so helpful in me growing my YouTube channel. So I thank you for that, George. And I'm putting out lots of great content there as well as on the podcast. And can't wait to see you at Rebel Capitalist Live. It's going to be an awesome event. Those are always so, you know, it's not just about money and learning, right? That's all great. But the best part is the social life. I mean, all of the
cocktail
great
parties
people.
With Doug Casey. I can't wait to have a beer with Doug Casey.
Doug's going to be there. That's right. Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Yeah. That's what's really great about it is the social experience and just literally the fun we have. So looking forward to seeing everybody there in Miami, Rebel Capitalist Live in just about a month, right?
Yeah, you got it. All right, buddy. Appreciate your time. Enjoy the rest of your day.
All right. Happy investing, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.